From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Israel invades another West Bank town, shells a hospital, and kills 10 people overnight. As U.S. officials criticize the CNN of the Arab world, Al Jazeera, we'll look at who the CNN of the Western world chooses as its terrorism experts, including a former Aryan Nations member convicted of possession of freeze-dried bubonic plague. The problem is he's not identified as a former member of the Aryan Nations, simply as an expert. Then Bangladeshi sweatshop workers say labor conditions in their country have worsened with the attacks of September 11th. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile. This is the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood and where the fire still burns. I'm Amy Goodman. A Pakistani militant group confirmed today that 22 of its fighters were killed in a U.S. attack on Kabul, the deadliest known strike against a group linked to Osama bin Laden since the U.S. began bombing Afghanistan October 7th. U.S. jets and bombers continue to launch heavy attacks against the Afghan capital with huge explosions in the direction of the Taliban military sites on the outskirts. The Pentagon has acknowledged that U.S. jets bombed a military hospital on the outskirts of the western Afghan city of Herat, this after the United Nations offered independent confirmation of the bombing. A UN spokeswoman told a news conference in Pakistan that the 100-bed hospital was struck on Sunday during a U.S. air raid. Afghanistan's ruling Taliban claims that 100 patients and medical workers were killed at the hospital. The U.S. has previously denied hitting the hospital and that the Pentagon has bought the exclusive rights to commercial satellite imagery that might have enabled reporters to independently confirm the reports. And a new poll by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press shows that U.S. citizens, by a 2-to-1 margin, say the best way to avoid terrorism is for the United States to get more involved in helping solve international problems. Israeli troops invaded the West Bank village of Beit Rima near Ramallah today as President Bush backed off from earlier demands that Israel immediately and permanently end its invasion and military occupation of Palestinian self-rule towns in the West Bank. Israeli troops killed 10 Palestinians overnight, according to Israeli radio. Palestinian witnesses said the army opened fire without provocation, shelling a hospital, among other buildings. In Bethlehem, Archbishop Pietro Sambi from the Vatican and several bishops led thousands of Palestinians on a march to Manger Square and the Church of the Nativity, chanting, "Sharon, Sharon, hear, hear, Bethlehem is an Arab city." The latest deaths brought to 38 the number of Palestinians killed since the Israeli military offensive in the West Bank was launched on October 18th. No Israelis have died. The House yesterday rushed through a bill authorizing the Treasury Department to issue war bonds to the public to help pay for U.S. military action and federal aid to Manhattan. The measure passed unanimously with only a handful of members on the floor after a parade of speakers in both parties said the legislation gives ordinary citizens a way to express their patriotism and get involved in the fight on terrorism. The Senate last month approved a similar measure as part of a bill funding the Treasury Department. Holy Cross Hospital in Washington, D.C. is now treating 5 D.C. postal workers for possible inhalation anthrax. The hospital says 2 more people with flu-like symptoms were admitted overnight. 2 postal workers, Joseph Kersine and Thomas Morris, died of what officials say was inhalation anthrax on Monday. Federal officials finally acknowledged yesterday they'd underestimated the danger that anthrax-contaminated letters pose to those who carry and sort the mail. Federal investigators still have no firm idea who is sending envelopes of the deadly microbe through the mail or what is motivating the attacks, according to lawmakers, public health experts, and law enforcement officials. Although they continue to operate under the assumption that there might be a link to the September 11th attacks, investigators from the FBI, the U.S. Postal Service, and other agencies told the Washington Post that the mailings do not have the earmarks of a foreign terrorist operation and seem more likely to have come from a domestic source. For the first time in 3 decades of resistance to British rule in Northern Ireland, the Irish Republican Army says it has disposed of some of its weapons, a move widely hailed as a major breakthrough for the deadlock peace process in the occupied country. The leader of the main pro-British party in Northern Ireland, David Trimble, said the move would likely revive the 1998 Good Friday power-sharing agreement between Catholics and Protestants, which had all but broken down in recent months over Protestant claims that the IRA had not been disarming. A U.S. military advisory team will visit a southern Philippine island of Basilan, a stronghold of guerrillas the Philippines government claims is linked to Osama bin Laden. 5 U.S. officers arrived in Zamboanga on Tuesday, and another 20 or so will arrive on Friday to provide advice and equipment in the battle against the Abu Sayyaf guerrillas. Philippine special forces, trained and equipped by the U.S. military, have killed at least 50 people in Basilan and the nearby island of Jolo, whom they say are guerrillas. The Abu Sayyaf guerrillas say they are fighting for an independent Muslim homeland in the south of the predominantly Catholic country, but Philippine officials say the group pursues kidnap for ransom as its main activity. And finally, the pharmaceutical giant Bayer, the maker of the drug Cipro, says it has reached tentative agreement with the U.S. government to significantly lower the drug's price. Officials with Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson said the agreement could lower the price of Cipro to under $1 per tablet compared to the current retail price of $4 or $5 per pill. The Bush administration has repeatedly refused to consider allowing other drug manufacturers to make cheaper generic equivalents of Cipro.
Oh, I am just a young man with my task ahead.
Proclaiming Jubilee, Stephen Smith here on the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. So the other day, I'm watching television, CNN, and I see a man talking about bioterrorism. And the little logo goes up underneath, you know, CNN, the new war, America's new war. And it says Larry Wayne Harris. He's a microbiologist. And he starts talking about things like bubonic plague and other things, one of the many experts on CNN. But I feel like I'm having some kind of flashback to a few years ago when I believe there was a man who was arrested for bubonic plague who was a member of the Aryan Nations. But they are not identifying him as such. He is simply being identified as an expert. And we do a little research and come up with a piece by Mary Beth Lane in Columbus, Ohio, called The Columbus Dispatch. She just did this. I gave her a call and asked her about this CNN guest. Why don't you tell us who is Larry Wayne Harris?
Okay. Well, Larry Wayne Harris is a microbiologist living in Lancaster, Ohio, a suburb of Columbus. He is also a former member of the Aryan Nations. And he has been regarded over the years by the federal government as a dangerous man because of his ties to white supremacist organizations and other anti-government groups.
Can you tell us his connection to anthrax?
Well, you know, back in 1997, he was arrested, wound up being convicted of wire fraud for illegally possessing 3 vials of freeze-dried bubonic plague germs. And then afterward, he was put on probation for that. But then the next year, in 1998, he was involved in an anthrax scare out in Las Vegas. And federal authorities arrested him and another man. But it turned out when Army scientists conducted some tests on this substance the men were carrying, it turned out to be anthrax vaccine and not the deadly anthrax itself. And so the charges were dropped in that incident. Larry Wayne Harris himself says that he has experimented over the years with different germs because he wants to develop antibodies. And so he says his experiments are done from a defensive standpoint and not offensive. Even so, as I say, the federal government does regard him as a dangerous individual, and authorities do keep an eye on him locally.
On CNN, he is not identified as a former member of the Aryan Nations or someone who has been found guilty of wire fraud or after illegally obtaining 3 vials of freeze-dried bubonic plague germs. They simply talk about him as a bioterrorism expert.
I don't know to what extent he is an expert. I know he says he's studied all this on his own, and he does have a self-published book that he sells on the internet, and he has a so-called decontamination kit that he sells on the internet. But even so, as I say, the federal government does regard him as dangerous because he does have these ties to the Aryan Nations. He says he's a former member of the Aryan Nations. He says he has disavowed violence. But even so, actually, I have interviewed Larry Wayne Harris now several times. Not all to do with germ warfare, but primarily to do with the individuals that he still knows and associates with in the Aryan Nations. I recently did a couple of stories about individuals here in Ohio who are leaders, one of whom has recently been named the national leader of the Aryan Nations. And these are people that Larry Wayne Harris knows very well. And so I've turned to him to interview him about these men who are the leaders in the Aryan Nations. And so he certainly does seem to have familiarity with the group, even if he is a former member. So that's his other identity and not just his experimenting with germs.
Who is the new head of the Aryan Nations?
He is a fellow from Ohio. He's from the Dayton area. His name is Harold Ray Redfearn. And we've done a couple of stories about this man recently because, as I say, he was named the national leader of Aryan Nations. And authorities both here, law enforcement authorities here in Ohio and elsewhere, as well as watchdog groups such as the Southern Anti-Poverty Law Center, viewed this with some concern, the naming of this man to be the new national leader. What would that mean? Did that mean, new activity by the group? Where would he locate his headquarters and so forth? And so anyway, that's Harold Ray Redfearn, the new national leader of the Aryan Nations, with a presence in Ohio. And he says he's setting up his national headquarters in central Pennsylvania.
You have a final quote in your piece on Larry Wayne Harris, where he says, "We've been at war with the Muslim world since 1948 with the formation of Israel. The weapons they've used have become more and more sophisticated." So he is pointing the finger at Arabs. Has there been any discussion in your newspaper, or have you had any conversations with him about the possibility that these anthrax attacks and hoaxes could come from within, right here, perhaps one of the groups he's associated with?
In my discussion with him, my interview with him most recently, he specifically pointed to Arab groups. Now, I don't know that he has any specific knowledge of this. I think I sensed he was giving an opinion more than anything else. Although having said that, he did go on to say that American anti-government groups, the militia types, that sort of thing, share a common enemy with the Arab groups. And his remarks about America's tensions with the Arab world, you know, stemming back to the formation of Israel, those remarks are very much in keeping, I might add, with other things he has said that are part of the philosophy, if you will, of the Aryan Nations hate group.
So, in summary, the drugs that he has gotten a hold of, that is the reason the federal government is watching him, are...
The reason that they're watching him is that back in 1977, he did, in fact, obtain illegally freeze-dried vials of bubonic plague germs. And so he was put on he was convicted and put on probation for that. The following year, then, in 1998, he was arrested in an anthrax scare out in Las Vegas. But it turned out, after Army scientists ran some tests, it turned out he was carrying anthrax vaccine and not deadly anthrax itself. And so charges against him were dropped in that incident.
This is the author of the piece in the Columbus Dispatch, Mary Beth Lane, writing about Larry Wayne Harris. Again, while he has appeared on CNN numerous times, they have not talked about him being a former member of the white supremacist group, the Aryan Nation, although at least in the time that I saw him on CNN. And today we're going to take a look at CNN's list of terrorism experts. We're going to look at Henry Kissinger, Oliver North, Richard Helms, and we're going to speak with Larry Wayne Harris himself. A news story from the Foreign Desk of the New York Times from October 9th reads, in an unconventional war in which propaganda is an essential weapon, an Arab-language satellite television channel is striking with relentless power. Only hours after the first American bombs and missiles dropped in Afghanistan, the channel, Al Jazeera, broadcast a videotape of Osama bin Laden, America's ultimate target. Since it began broadcasting 5 years ago, Al Jazeera has become the Arab world's CNN, with round-the-clock all-news public affairs programs that reach millions of viewers in scores of countries from its base in the tiny Persian Gulf Emirate of Qatar. But American policymakers have been troubled by Al Jazeera's frequent broadcasts of its exclusive December 98 interview with Mr. bin Laden, and by the anti-American oratory of many of its analysts and guests, and from callers on freewheeling phone-in shows. Al Jazeera's relentless coverage of rioting in the occupied territories from its bureaus in Ramallah, Gaza City, and rented studio in Jerusalem have kept the Palestinian cause front and center in living rooms throughout the Muslim world. Over and over last year, it played the video of a young Palestinian boy and his father cowering on the side of a building moments before the boy was killed by Israeli troops. That's an excerpt of a piece in the New York Times. Well, while focusing overwhelmingly on the CNN of the Arab world, commentators have failed to subject the CNN of the Western world to the same kind of scrutiny. Today on the War and Peace Report, we're going to take a look at some of the people CNN turns to for expert analysis. One of those people is Larry Wayne Smith, and he joins us on the telephone right now. We're also joined by Chip Berlay with Political Research Associates and author of Right Wing Populism in America. Larry Wayne Harris, welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile.
Thank you very much for having me on this
morning. It's good to have you with us. How many times have you been on CNN?
Oh, about 13 times.
And you're talking about how easy it is to get biological weapons in this country.
Absolutely. Now, you know, the thing about it is, with biological weapons is as big as nature itself. You know what I'm saying? It's as big as nature itself. Because right now, there's 48 laboratories in the world that will sell anthrax, bubonic plague, cholera, typhoid, brucellosis, tularema, to anybody that's got the money. As a matter of fact, you can go to Mexico City, just across the border of Mexico, and there is zero restrictions on it. They have several laboratories down there. Repositories that you can just walk in, and again, there's no restrictions whatsoever. Matter of fact, it is easier to get anthrax than it is Tylenol with codeine.
Now, what have you yourself been able to procure?
Basically, several years ago, I was doing research when I wrote my book, Bacteriological Warfare: A Major Threat to North America. I'm a registered microbiologist. And so I needed to run MICs minimum inhibitory concentrations and also MBC, minimum bactericidal concentrations, and using various agricultural antibiotics that people can acquire without a prescription to the feed and grain store. And I ordered 3 vials of avirulent Yersinia pestis, which is the non-virulent form of bubonic plague.
Have you also gotten anthrax?
As far as the vaccine, I use Vaccinia vaccine. As a matter of fact, and by the way, even right now, that is totally unrestricted, the vaccine, which is totally avirulent. The only way that you can hurt somebody with that, if you made a 55-gallon drum of it and dropped it on your foot. I mean, literally. I've always been a very cautious microbiologist and very concerned about anybody getting infected. As a matter of fact, when I was working with clinical specimens, any clinical specimen that come in that I suspected was could be a dangerous pathogen, I was always using laminar flow hoods and everything of this nature. Or especially we're working with tularema, because you know if you're not very careful with that stuff, you'll get it all over the laboratory, everywhere. So I've always tried to practice a very conscious microbiology.
Larry Wayne Harris, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. We come back. We'll also be joined by Chip Berlay as we continue to discuss the issue of how easy it is to get biological weapons in this country. Stay with us.
Did I drink some poison?
Did I drink some poison?
That I don't remember now.
That I don't remember now. Is the blood on my hands? No, my hands are clean. Did I do something in another lifetime that was really, really me?
Yeah, I'm hearing voices. Am I losing my mind? Think I'm going crazy, gotta get out.
Running into the street, start to shout. Get out of my way. Get out. Did I drink some poison that I don't remember now? Is the blood on my hands?
Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile. Back to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Larry Wayne Harris, a microbiologist who has been able to easily obtain various biological warfare like freeze-dried bubonic plague. Now, you pled guilty to wire fraud after illegally obtaining the 3 vials of this stuff?
Well, I got caught up on a technicality, and of course, the technicality that I got caught up of, yes, I was guilty as far as the technicality goes. But as far as owning the vial, obtaining the vials and stuff of this nature, there was nothing illegal about doing it. As a matter of fact, the vials that I acquired then, there is right now, because they're avirulent strains, there's no restriction on obtaining them now. Same thing with the Vaccinia strain.
Now, you're a former member of the Aryan Nations?
Born into it.
What do you mean?
My great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather was in England in 1855. When he attended a meeting there, which is called British Israelism, and through the years, my great-grandfather was into it when it became known as Kingdom Identity. And again, I didn't wake up one morning and decide I'm going to go out and join the Aryan Nation. I was born into it, raised into it.
Are you still a member?
There is no Aryan Nation anymore.
What about groups like yours, the Aryan Nations, being able to get this kind of biological warfare, and how much is being stashed in this country by these groups?
First off, of all of the people that I've ever known, my procedure was, and I've told people this before, if I ever suspected anybody was trying to get a biological weapon, I would personally turn them into the FBI, because right now there's no point. Many of the groups in the United States have now been linking up with the Muslim groups. And the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and they see a common enemy, and there's no point for American patriots to start getting or acquiring biological weapons when the Muslims have got factories, they've got the laboratories, they've got all the facilities to manufacture it and bring it in and release it. I mean, there is absolutely no point. It's like somebody going down trying to kick a hole in the side of the Titanic after she kicked hit the iceberg. There's no point. All you have to do is train people how to defend against it. And once, again, just by sheer numbers, when people learn how to defend against it, you know the Muslims have got the laboratories, they've got the equipment, they got the agents, they got everything necessary to release the agents. And just like we are now helping the Northern Alliance, again, the Taliban, many of the Muslims have linked up with American Patriot groups and to help them against the what they considered to be an occupational government.
We're also joined on the telephone by Chip Berlay, who is with Political Research Associates in Cambridge, Mass. In looking at right-wing populism in this country and groups like Aryan Nations, Chip Berlay, what about this issue of the possibility of them having biological warfare? I should say in the news headlines we read today in a Washington Post piece that the Washington Post in interviews with FBI, U.S. Postal Service, and other agencies said the mailings don't have the earmarks of a foreign terrorist operation and seem more likely to have come from a domestic source.
Well, I don't think anybody knows where they're coming from, and I think all the speculation is a lot of hot air. There's at least 9 different suspect groups, including the Osama bin Laden networks or other Muslim Arab terrorists. It could be agents of an anti-U.S. government doing this as a what's called a false flag operation and using this as cover. It could be people in the extreme right, like Aryan Nations, which is still around, thank you very much. Could be people in the Patriot Militia Movement, the more militant people. It could be crazy people. Nobody knows. But what I think is really interesting here is to point out what's going on with Mr. Harris. And he talks about the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And, of course, in Christian identity, most Christian identity believers think Jews are the spawn of Satan. Isn't that right, Mr. Harris?
Some of the people may consider that, not everybody.
So don't you think folks might be a little nervous that someone who hangs out with folks who think that people of color are mud people and Jews are the spawn of Satan and should be exterminated, that you like sort of mess around with toxins? Don't you think like the average person might be a little nervous about that?
Again, I've always had an open door policy here with the FBI. They've stopped by a few times. They see that everything that we do here, there is absolutely nothing that would harm anyone and stuff of this nature. And again, there's no point. There's absolutely no point to develop biological weapons for the patriot groups in this country to develop biological weapons, because we know that the Muslims are developing the biological weapons and they got the infrastructure to deliver the biological weapons. And the only thing that we have to do is train the people how to defend against the biological weapons. And again, the end is the same. The means and end is the same.
We're talking to Larry Wayne Harris, who has been able to get biological weapons, also a former member of the Aryan Nations, and Chip Berlay, who writes about right-wing groups in this country. Mr. Harris, have you read Jim Ridgway's piece in the Village Voice?
No, I have not.
Well, he writes this piece, actually, about you. Talks about an American microbiologist who was captured by the FBI in Ohio during the late 90s with vials of bacterium that causes the bubonic plague. He also told a major magazine he had recovered anthrax. Now, he goes on to speculate and says that speculation about the recent anthrax scare centers on Muslim extremists, but white supremacists cannot be ignored, especially as abortion clinics around the country report receiving letters containing suspicious powder. Some of these letters reference domestic terrorists like the Army of God. Have you had dealings with the Army of God?
I haven't even heard of them. Yeah, you mentioned it.
The group that deals with...
Like I said, I've never even heard it until you just mentioned it.
Could I explain a few things here?
Yes, go ahead, Chip.
Okay. The Ridgway article was really pretty bad. I'm not a big fan of Mr. Harris. I'm really his political opponent. But the Ridgway article neglected to mention that many of the charges that were hyped in the article were dismissed. So let's start with the fact that Mr. Harris, in my view, is neither an appropriate expert on terrorism and chemical biological warfare, but neither is he a poster boy for claims that the U.S. political right is behind the current wave of anthrax attacks. It's just this was a hype article, and it misrepresented Mr. Harris, and that's difficult to do because he's a pretty scary person from my point of view. The Army of God is part of a militant wing of the Christian right with some overlap with the militias, but it's largely a tiny militant anti-abortion sector of the Christian right, not the militias. The militias are not part of the extreme right, which includes Aryan Nations. And what's happening here, which has tremendous repercussions in civil liberties, is lumping together the Christian right, the Patriot militia movement, and the extreme right as somehow one big scary group of people out to kill us with toxins. And as much as I think it's possible that right-wing groups are involved in these anthrax attacks, and they're certainly involved in the hoaxes, and the hoax letters sent to Planned Parenthood are sent by the Army of God, but there's a lot of really bad reporting going on.
Yes, like I said, if you've read my book, Bacteriological Warfare, A Major Threat to North America, you'll find that my book is a civil defense manual. It is a manual that tells people how to defend, again, biological weapons. It identifies biological weapons, and everyone that has ever read the book says flat out that, again, some people try to say it's a manual for germ warfare, and after people read it, they said, whoever's saying it's crazy.
No, I think you could read it that way. And, Mr. Harris, having you on as a biological terrorism expert is like having David Duke on as an expert on race relations.
Well, like I said, again, my expertise is in basically in how to defend against germ warfare. That is my expertise. How is in defense. I have never operated in offense. Matter of fact, when I was in the Army, I turned down a promotion when I was up at Aberdeen Proving Grounds, but if I would have gone over into a section that would have been almost classified as offense. I always worked in defense.
Yeah, but what's a defense against what? Because, of course, a lot of Christian identity people believe the government is an occupational government, and they call it the Zionist occupational government in the U.S. because they think Jews run the world. Now, you've heard that, I assume.
I've heard it espoused by a few people. For the most part, though, you find out that the people in the Christian groups they do Bible study, they do extensive archaeology, biblical archaeology, and it's more, if you want what you want to call Christian identity, it's more biblical archaeology.
Well, you think that you're part of the God's Promise people, don't you?
Basically, we are. The Caucasians are the true Israelites.
So you're the Jews, and the people who claim to be Jews are fakers. Right? Are they fakers because they stole the religion, or are they the spawn of the devil? Those are the two leading themes.
Basically, you had the northern 10 tribes were taken in captivity by the Assyrian army and then placed in the Caucasus Mountains, and you had the southern tribe of Judah and Benjamin, which was taken by Nebuchadnezzar, and then was finally destroyed by Titus and Vespasian and Titus in 70 A.D. So, again, it is a... with the birth of Christ, it became a dead religion. The temple was destroyed. There was no need for it. So, again, it is a dead issue.
So you're the sworn enemy of both Jews and Arabs.
No. Matter of fact, I was in Denver in August teaching in some Jewish synagogues, and if I'm such a enemy of Jews, I certainly would not have been teaching in a synagogue.
But you don't think that the synagogues represent Jews?
Again, I tell people, ask you the question, how many Jews caught a cold last year?
That makes no sense to me.
It makes every bit of sense in the world because, again, in order to be a Jew, you had to be a Judean, and Judea was destroyed in 70 A.D.
Let me go back to the issue at hand, which is bioterrorism. Larry Wayne Harris, do you think it's going to get worse in this country?
Most definitely.
And do you think it's coming from here?
No. It is definitely coming from overseas.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. Larry Wayne Harris, microbiologist, former member of the Aryan Nations. Chip Berlay, political research associates, writes about right-wing groups in this country. And we're going to continue our discussion of CNN's list of experts on terrorism. Just recently, and it could be any day of the week, this was Paula Zahn introducing Henry Kissinger.
I'm joined now by Dr. Henry Kissinger, the man that so many of us turn to try to unscramble some of the confusion that we are inundated with at the moment. Welcome. Good to have you with us
good
this morning.
Here.
Let's start off with the latest development. We know that Pakistan's top spy and a former...
Just one few second clip of CNN, Henry Kissinger, frequently on the networks talking about the issue of terrorism. I was traveling to Olympia, Washington, and an Ecuadorian man came up to me and said his brother had been killed by Ecuadorian authorities, was a journalist. And he said, did you know that September 11th was the day that Salvador Allende died in Chile when Pinochet rose to power? And I thought it was an interesting point just to remember what has happened all over the world as this terrible atrocity has taken place here at home, this act of terrorism against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, where we're just blocks from more than 5,000 people who have been buried alive, incinerated. But to look at the people who are commenting on what should be done now, it's quite instructive. And we're joined by Peter Kornbluh. Peter Kornbluh is the author of the Iran-Contra chronology, the Iran-Contra scandal, a declassified history, and a leading scholar on U.S. policy in Central and Latin America. In fact, Peter, if I recall correctly, we were interviewing you on September 11th on Democracy Now! In Exile when just afterwards we heard about what was happening just blocks from us.
That is true. Well, you and I will always remember that day, as will so many of your listeners.
Well, you were talking that day about Rene Schneider in Chile, and you were talking about documents that had just been declassified that involved Henry Kissinger. And today we're talking about the list of terrorism experts on TV, maybe in the sense of it takes one to know one. But can you talk just very briefly about Henry Kissinger's involvement in the coup there?
Well, in the fall of 1970, Richard Nixon called Henry Kissinger and Richard Helms into his office and told them he wanted to see a military coup take place in Chile to prevent the democratically elected socialist president to be, Salvador Allende, from actually being inaugurated. And the documents are very clear that the responsibility for overseeing this project was Henry Kissinger's, and certainly Richard Helms's as well, and that the CIA did everything it could to foment upheaval and unrest in Chile in the fall of 1970 in order to create what CIA documents call a coup climate, a psychological climate in which the military would be more likely to move to block Allende's actual inauguration. And those operations included support for small terrorist groups. At one point, the CIA did approach a fanatic extreme right-winger, which is relative to all the right-wingers they were working with, who, in fact, was contemplating the assassination of Salvador Allende. They decided that he was too fanatical to be worthwhile to work with, and they didn't continue to work with him. But they did work with a group that was going to instigate this coup by kidnapping the Chilean commander-in-chief of the armed forces, General Rene Schneider. And this was supposed to set in motion a number of events that would bring the military to power. The documents are unclear the extent to which Kissinger was specifically briefed on that element of the plan, because they're heavily redacted. But it seems clear that his office was kept abreast of this coup plotting, and Schneider was not kidnapped. He was actually shot and died. Among the new CIA documents are ones where is a document where, after discussion with Richard Helms, the CIA sent a cable to its station in Santiago complimenting the station on a job well done after Schneider had been shot. And this is the truth and the darkness of our own history, which is at least worth remembering and understanding as we contemplate those who are speaking on terrorism today.
I wanted to ask you also about some other people we're seeing on a regular basis on CNN and the networks, like Oliver North and Richard Helms, but we also are joined by Veronica De Negri, who is Chilean woman lives in Washington, D.C. right now, victim of the coup, one of thousands. Very briefly, Veronica, we have had you on before. As we hear about the stories of those who were lost in the World Trade Center, it's easy to say 5,000, not even to say that, but we have to think about each individual life that was lost. I thought, as I was walking around one night, because we stayed at the firehouse for days after so that we could continue to report, of the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina carrying those same pictures we see carried here of people looking for their loved ones. What happened to you under Pinochet, a coup that was supported by the U.S.?
Many different things happened to me. It's a long history of things that happened to me during after the coup d'etat in Chile. And as I want to refer to the fact that what you just mentioned, the mothers of Plaza de Mayo in Argentina, but we cannot just name one country. Don't forget that just in the Latin American countries, in early 90s, where over 90,000 disappears, over 90,000 people looking for their loved one. And as you say, it's not important just one person. The whole amount, what is important is how many people is affected, because it's not just the mother, the daughter, the whoever relative is, affect the whole life. And that's what happened to me with Chile. First of all, my compañero, the father of my son, was killed, was executed. After I was arrested, my family was, some of my relatives were arrested, or they went to exile. I came to United States, and which I'm very thankful for, in 1977, after being released from a concentration camp. And in 1986, my son, my oldest son, returned to Chile, and he was burned alive by military forces. And my life has been torn down too many times with these things. We have, through over 20 years, fighting for justice, and we don't have it. And when I see all these people, I don't watch CNN. First of all, I don't have cable. But when I had the chance before in other houses, it made me sick to see all these criminals, because in reality, to me, they are criminals. Even here, they are treated like heroes. They have so much responsibility over the pain of the people. I think the best way to do it is to do it to an international court. It's been very... we don't need to be killing and bombing people to take a crazy one from a part of the world. I think we have to be responsible, and part of the responsibility is not create more hate among us. Because one of the things I devote my life now is to stop the hatred and use our head. And precious the life of every individual on the world. It's so amazing to me how we use God for everything. And the less things you really do with the action is respect God's voice for those that believe.
Veronica De Negri, I want to thank you very much for being with us, bringing your own life experience and wisdom to this conversation. Peter Kornbluh, you have well documented U.S. involvement in the coup in Chile, which killed thousands, including the family member's son of Veronica De Negri. You've also documented what happened in Nicaragua. Of course, you are the author of the Iran-Contra scandal, Declassified History. Your thoughts when you see Oliver North on television, if you could just give us a brief sketch, especially for people who weren't even born at the time who listened to Democracy Now! In Exile, of what he did in Nicaragua.
Well, there's a common expression now that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. But in the case of Oliver North and some others that have become pundits on this issue, it's one man's freedom fighter is the same man's terrorist. In the name of promoting democracy and freedom in Nicaragua and Central America. Oliver North was involved in a number of operations, which certainly were terrorist in their design and mission. The particular operation in the spring of 1985, he contracted with the authorization of superiors to pay $50,000 to a British mercenary to blow up an arms depot in downtown Managua. And this was totally for propaganda purposes, to show the U.S. Congress that the Contras were able to operate inside of the capital city of Nicaragua. This depot was blown up, and the fire from it spread immediately to a hospital next door and burned down the hospital. And therefore, for propaganda purposes, it was a lost cause. The Contras and Oliver North couldn't claim credit for this because they had burned down a hospital and killed civilians. In the quest to support the Contras illegally, Oliver North raised money that was paid to a Middle Eastern arms broker named Mansour Al-Qassar. More than $1.5 million worth of weapons were bought from him. He was also the main arms dealers for a number of known terrorist groups in the Middle East at the time, and this was known to the U.S. government at the time. But it was a question of bedfellows and priorities. And those are the kinds of priorities that led us to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, simply to bleed the Soviet Union with total disregard to the real position of the Mujahideen toward.
One last person I wanted to get to, CIA Director Richard Helms, and we only have a minute, who we see, the former director, on television quite a lot.
CIA Director Helms' long tenure at the agency in a director's role, that the CIA did engage in efforts to assassinate Fidel Castro, but perhaps more importantly, trained Cuban exiles in the art of terrorist activities, bombings, shooting bazookas. We worked very closely with the man who is now the most renowned Cuban exile terrorist, Luis Posada Carriles, who's currently in prison in Panama for trying to kill Fidel Castro and has been linked by multiple evidence to the bombings of tourist hotels in Cuba in the mid-1990s.
And if the Bush administration were serious about fighting terrorism today, what could they do right now? You write about this in The Nation in Chile.
Thing they could do is indict Augusto Pinochet for the car bombing of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt here in Washington, D.C. in 1976.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Peter Kornbluh, the website where people can go to see all the documents, the National Security Archives?
NSArchive.org.
And I want to thank Veronica Denegri. And we're going to break, and when we come back, we're joined by Bangladeshi workers in our Firehouse studio to talk about what's happening in Bangladesh today, which is professed to be a strong ally of the war on terrorism, allying itself with the United States. We'll hear about the Disney factories and others in the country of Bangladesh. Stay with us.
Listen in to my stethoscope on a rope. Internal lullabies, human cries, thumps in silence, the language of violence. Algorithmic, cataclysmic, seismic, biorhythmic. You can make a life longer, but you can't save it. You can make a clone and then you try to enslave it. Stealing DNA samples from the unborn, and then you coming after us because we sampled a James Brown horn. Scientists whose god is progress. A four-headed sheep is their latest project. The CIA running like they're Jones from Indiana, but they still won't talk about that Jones in Guyana. This ain't no cartoon. No one slips on bananas. Do you really think that that car killed Diana? Hell, I shot Ronald Reagan. I shot JFK. I slept with Marilyn. She sung me happy birthday. My, oh my God. In my mind, they got a slipping suicide singing. Oh my God. In my mind, they got a slipping genocide singing. Oh my God.
You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile, the War and Peace Report. Michael Franti, as usual, here on our program, Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Bangladeshi Muslims continue to hold anti-U.S. protests in Dhaka, Bangladesh, urging the United Nations to stop the United States to stop attacks on Afghanistan. At a demonstration Monday, police prevented protesters from marching to the UN mission in Dhaka, but allowed them to hand over a letter to the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, urging him to initiate immediate moves to try to halt U.S.-led air and ground attacks on Afghanistan. Bangladesh new government, an alliance between the Bangladesh Nationalist Party and the Islamic Fundamentalist Party, Jamaat-e-Islam, is under some pressure to pull out of the so-called coalition against terrorism. Today, we're going to take a look at the anti-sweatshop movement in Bangladesh. Anti-sweatshop watchdog groups say that in the aftermath of the events of September 11th attacks and the growing U.S. recession, conditions in the Bangladesh garment industry have worsened. They say in Bangladesh, one of the major Islamic export nations, between 700 and 1,000 garment factories have been shut down, throwing hundreds of thousands of young women workers into the streets without severance pay or savings. Bangladeshi garment workers have traveled to the U.S. to call on universities, many of whose caps, T-shirts, and sweatshirts are made in Bangladesh, to assure that pay and working conditions conform with Bangladeshi labor laws. And we're joined by two workers now from the plants, as well as an organizer in Bangladesh. We're joined by Nasreen Akhtar, a sewing operator, as well as Janu Akhtar, who worked for 10 years in the garment sector in Bangladesh. Sheikh Nasma is also with us, who is with the Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity. They'll be translated by Rafiqil Alam, who is the coordinator for the National Labor Committee's Bangladesh program. If you could each just briefly tell us where you work and the conditions.
আমি নাসরিন আক্তার আমি বাংলাদেশ থেকে আসছি আমার বয়স 21 বছর
আই এম নাসরিন আক্তার আই এম 22 ইয়ার্স ওল্ড আই এম ফ্রম বাংলাদেশ
আমি গার্মেন্টস শাহ মখদুম গার্মেন্টসে চাকরি করি
আই ওয়ার্ক ইন দা গার্মেন্টস শাহ মখদুম
আমাদের ওইখানে সকাল 8টা থেকে রাত 8টা অথবা 10টা পর্যন্ত ডিউটি হয়
আই স্টার্ট মাই ওয়ার্ক 8 ইন দা মর্নিং এন্ড ইট টিলস সামটাইমস 10 এট নাইট
আমাদের এখানে কাজের পরিবেশ অনেক নোংরা আমাদের এখানে খাওয়ার পরিবেশ নেই আমাদের এখানে
দ্য ফ্যাক্টরি আই ওয়ার্ক ইট ইজ ভেরি ডার্টি দ্যার ইজ নো এনাফ ভেন্টিলেশন এনাফ এয়ার এনাফ লাইট
আমাদের এখানে সুপারভাইজার মার পিট করে আমাদের ওভারটাইম করায় ঠিকমতো ওভারটাইম দেয় না
দ্যার ইজ নো ডাইনিং ফ্যাসিলিটিস নো ক্যাফেটেরিয়া উই হ্যাভ টু হ্যাভ ফুড অন ওপেন স্পেস ইন ফ্রন্ট অফ আওয়ার ফ্যাক্টরি ইন দ্য রোড
আমাদের যত বেতন দেওয়ার কথা আমাদের বাংলাদেশে লেবার লতে যা আছে সেটা আমরা ঠিকমতো পাই না
আওয়ার সুপারভাইজার্স দে টিচ আস ভেরি রাফলি দে সামটাইমস বিট আস পাঞ্চ আস শাউটেড অ্যাট আস এন্ড উই ক্যান নট গেট এনি আওয়ার প্রপার স্যালারি হুইচ স্টেট হ্যাজ বিন ডিক্লেয়ার্ড
আই ওয়ান্টেড টু ব্রিং চার্লি কার্নিগান ইনটু দ্য কনভারসেশন টু টেল আস অ্যাবাউট দ্য ফ্যাক্টরি দ্যাট ইউ ওয়ার্ক ইন ইউএস টার্মস হু ওনস ইট চার্লি কার্নিগান ইজ হেড অফ দ্য ন্যাশনাল লেবার কমিটি এন্ড হি ইজ জয়নিং আস অন দ্য টেলিফোন চার্লি ওয়েলকাম
ইয়েস গুড মর্নিং
ইটস গুড টু হ্যাভ ইউ উইথ আস
Thank you. Basically, these factories are owned, many of them by Bangladesh nationals, the very highest elite, ex-brigadier generals, ex-ministers of the government, opposition figures, and it's the perhaps the worst exploitation we've ever seen. The standard 12 to 14-hour shifts, 7-day work weeks, maybe 2 days off a month at most, physical punishment, like you heard, and starvation wages, 13 to 17 cents an hour. And so the trip here is really meant to target universities to keep their production in Bangladesh, not to cut and run at this minute. Hundreds of thousands of young women have been thrown out on the streets with nothing. I mean, no severance pay, no unemployment insurance, no safety net, no savings. We've exploited these young women for years, paying them starvation wages, working them 14 hours a day, up to 20 hours when shipments had to go out. They would work from 8 in the morning until 4 o'clock in the morning, then sleep on the factory floor and start all over again at 8 o'clock. If they tried to defend themselves, they were hit, punched, hit with sticks. If they tried to organize, they were fired and blacklisted. If they tried to get the maternity benefits, they'd be denied their maternity benefits. In other words, we've exploited these people for years, and now that there's a slowdown in the economy, we throw them out onto the street with nothing.
Okay. Charlie Kernighan with the National Labor Committee. The description we just heard from Nasreen Akhtar, the sewing operator, is actually at a Disney-owned factory. And Janu Akhtar, also working in the garment sector for university for a factory that makes caps for universities. Can you tell us your story, Janu?
Good morning. I am Janu Akhtar. I am Bangladesh. Ami actor garmentse charki kori, swing operator. Shekhane sokal 5ta baje ghum theke uthe ranna kore.
I am Janu Akhtar. I have been working in actor sports and I start my working at 8 in the morning.
সকাল 7টা বাজে ঘর থেকে বের হই রাত 11টা বাজে ঘরে যাই
and I have to work till 10 p.m. at night
যা বেতন দেওয়ার কথা তা বেতন দেয় না
the salary we are getting is very poor
and বিশুদ্ধ পানির ব্যবস্থা নেই ডাক্তার নেই
and in our factory I drink filthy water tap water that is not safe there is no medical care system if anyone falls sick There is no system to take care, to be treated.
Union karar shirkiri dai na.
And in my factory, organized to union, it is strictly prohibited.
I'd also like to hear from the union organizer, Sheikh Nazma, with founder of the Bangladesh Center for Workers' Solidarity.
I am Sheikh Nazma, Bangladesh Center for Workers' Solidarity. আমি অর্গানাইজিং করি এবং গার্মেন্টস ওয়ার্কারদের ট্রেনিং দিই আমাদের সংগঠনে সচেতন বলে এবং আমিও
আই অ্যাম শেখ নাজমা ফ্রম বাংলাদেশ সেন্টার ফর ওয়ার্কার সলিডারিটি আই অর্গানাইজ দ্য গার্মেন্ট ওয়ার্কার্স টু ট্রেন দেম টু গিভ দেম লিগাল অ্যাওয়ারনেস সো দ্যাট দে হ্যাভ সাম নলেজ অ্যাবাউট দেয়ার লিগাল রাইটস
মানব অধিকারের অধিকার শেখায় নিজের অধিকার
আই ট্রেন দ্য গার্মেন্ট ওয়ার্কার অ্যাবাউট দ্য হিউম্যান রাইটস
আমাদের বাংলাদেশের লজ খুব ভালো আছে সেগুলো বাস্তবায়ন হয় না এই জন্য শ্রমিকদেরকে সচেতন করি
ইন মাই কান্ট্রি লেবার লজ আর ভেরি গুড বাট ইন নো ফ্যাক্টরি দিস লজ আর বিং ইমপ্লিমেন্টেড দেয়ার আর অলওয়েজ ভায়োলেশন অফ লজ
উই অনলি হ্যাভ এ মিনিট এন্ড আই ওয়ান্টেড টু আস্ক চার্লি কার্নিগান ফর পিপল ইন দিস কান্ট্রি টু আন্ডারস্ট্যান্ড দ্য কানেকশন টু দ্য ইউনিভার্সিটি স্টোরস ওয়্যার ইউ ক্যান গেট ইয়োর টি-শার্টস এন্ড ক্যাপস দ্যাট দিস ওমেন হ্যাভ মেড হোয়াট পিপল ক্যান ডু
Well, they should know, first of all, that the women have paid a penny and a half for each cap they make for the universities, which then sell for $17, $18, $19. So what we're asking the students to do, and we're working with United Students Against Sweatshops and NYPERG in New York State, the students should go to their administrations and say, this is not the time to cut and run from Bangladesh. This is not the time to throw these young girls out onto the street. Let's keep our university production in Bangladesh. And let's work with these contractors and our licensees to clean up conditions so that the workers' rights are respected and that they're paid a fair wage. By the way, the workers say that they a living or subsistence level wage for them to climb out of misery and into poverty would be 34 cents an hour.
I know that women are going across the country to speak about these issues. Where can people call to find out if they'll be coming to their communities?
Well, obviously they could call our number at the National Labor Committee office at 212-242-3002, or they can go to the website where the schedule is posted, and that's www.nlcnet.org.
I want to thank you all very much for being with us. It's only the beginning of this discussion. That does it for today's program. And Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our technical director. Errol Maitland at the helm at WBIX.org, where you can hear us, as well as at webactive.com. Special thanks to Amy Pomerlo at KPFA, all of KPFA, KFCF, and all of our Pacifica affiliates. We are Pacifica. Downtown Community Television is where we're based, in Exile from the Embattled Studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Oh my God. In my mind, I got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God. In my mind, I got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. Oh my God. Slam, bam, I come on the scene, but like gasoline, you can tell I'm in the tank, like money in the bank. I smell appealing.
but I'm toxic. Can send you reeling without an inkling. Keep you thinking, cause you gave cash to the feds, left your school district for dead. You up in the head, but still they saying nothing's wrong. Selling fire water by outlawing the bong. Still believing the system is working, while half of my people are still out of working. Anonymous notes left in the pockets.
From Democracy Now in Exile, this is the War and Peace Report.
What's happening now in Palestine is that Sharon's government is using the world's being busy with Afghanistan to continue his plans not to achieve peace in the Middle East.
Israel invades another West Bank town, shells a hospital, and kills 10 people overnight. We'll have a report from the director of the medical center that was shelled. Then we'll hear part two of the major anti-war address by Noam Chomsky, and we'll talk to Muslim liberation theologian Faridi Saq. Stay with us. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is now the second. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli troops invaded the West Bank village of Beit Rima near Ramallah today as President Bush backed off from earlier demands that Israel immediately and permanently end its invasion and military occupation of Palestinian self-ruled towns in the West Bank. Israeli troops killed 10 Palestinians overnight, according to Israel Radio. Palestinian witnesses said the army fired without provocation, shelling a hospital among other buildings. In Bethlehem, the Archbishop Pietro Sambi from the Vatican and several bishops led thousands of Palestinians on a march to Manger Square, chanting, "Sharon, Sharon, hear, hear, Bethlehem is an Arab city." We go now to the director of the Beit Sahur Medical Center to talk about what has happened in Bethlehem.
The hospital in Bethlehem was shelled several times because most of the clashes are taking place in that area. Also, the University of Bethlehem have been shelled heavily. According to the directors of the university, over 100 pieces have fallen over the university compound, touching almost every room in it except of the library. The shelling is still continuing heavily in Bethlehem. There are dozens of casualties and numbers of people killed. At the clinic where I work in Beit Sahur, we had several bullets coming into the upper floor and also reaching the operating theater, which caused us to abandon the first floor and go down to the ground floor.
Is it possible for the Israeli army not to know that the medical center is a hospital?
Well, there is a big flag over the building with a red cross on it, and everyone knows the clinic in Beit Sahur, and everyone knows the hospital in Bethlehem, so I don't think they wouldn't know, but the shooting is mostly at random, and those bullets touch everything that lying ahead. We are calling on the people not to move on the streets because of stray bullets or the Israeli snipers. Minutes ago, we received that a man was shot in his own car in Bethlehem, just near the Bethlehem hospital. At the same time, what's much more worrying is what is happening in a village near Ramallah called Beit Rima. Until now, we hear the news from the local TV there that over 12 people from the village were killed and over 50 injured. There are over 1,000 soldiers entering the village, and it's almost a massacre there.
What do you think needs to be done now, and what about the U.S. role?
I think what is needed to be done now is an immediate stop of the Israeli invasion into the Palestinian cities, and that should be done immediately. We cannot wait longer. The American president and the American Congress must put harsh pressure on Israel to stop this invasion. It is going to be massacre-like circumstances. And only the United States and the United States president can stop the Israelis from continuing this madness.
And how does this fit into the war on Afghanistan, what Israel is doing?
Well, we have actually nothing to do with the war in Afghanistan. What's happening now in Palestine is that Sharon's government is using the world's being busy with Afghanistan to continue his plans not to achieve peace in the Middle East. As we all know, Sharon was opposing the Oslo Agreement from the very beginning, and he was opposing the withdrawal of the Israeli soldiers from the Palestinian cities. He is opposing the peaceful settlement, and what he is trying now is to push the Palestinians into a surrender-like situation where he can impose his conditions as he likes.
Dr. Majid Nassar, he's head of the Beit Sahur Medical Center right next to Bethlehem, one of the hospitals that has gotten shelled by the Israeli army. You're listening to the War and Peace Report.
Stop the war now.
Good God, hear me say,
don't put it off
another day. Everybody says,
stop the war
now, 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 now.
Don't put it off
another day. All we got to do is listen. If you ask them to fight again, what do you think they'd say? I'm not trying to be funny, I'm just trying to get my point across. War is world's enemy number one, and it's time that we called it off.
Ow! Stop the war! Now!
Good God, hear me say it.
Don't put it off
another day. Everybody sing it.
Stop the war!
Stop the war now. Edwin Starr here on Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. Holy Cross Hospital in Washington, D.C. is now treating 5 D.C. postal workers for possible inhalation anthrax. The hospital says 2 more people with flu-like symptoms were admitted overnight. 2 postal workers, Joseph Christine and Thomas Morris, died of what officials say was inhalation anthrax. Officials finally acknowledged yesterday they'd underestimated the danger that anthrax-contaminated letters pose to those who carry and sort the mail. Federal investigators still have no firm idea who's sending the envelopes of the deadly microbe through the mail or what's motivating the attacks, although they continue to operate under the assumption that there might be a link to the September 11th attacks. Investigators from the FBI, the U.S. Postal Service, and other agencies told the Washington Post that the mailings do not have the earmarks of a foreign terrorist operation and seem more likely to have come from a domestic source. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has approved the development of a genetically modified super anthrax bacteria to test U.S. defenses against biological attack, overriding concerns that the research could violate a 1972 germ warfare treaty. According to Milton Leitenberg, an expert on biological warfare at the University of Maryland, the Defense Department had intended to update its vaccine before the September 11th attacks, but postponed the project after the news was leaked to the press. We're going to continue our discussion about the so-called war on terrorism with Noam Chomsky, part 2 of the address we began yesterday. Noam Chomsky is a professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a world-renowned policy analyst, particularly a critic of U.S. foreign policy. He gave this anti-war address last week at MIT. Noam Chomsky.
What are the origins of the September 11th crimes? Here we have to make a distinction between two categories, which shouldn't be run together. One is the actual agents of the crime. The other is a kind of a reservoir of at least sympathy, sometimes support, that they appeal to even among people who very much oppose the criminals and the actions. And those are two different things. Well, with regard to the perpetrators, in a certain sense, we're not really clear. The United States either is unable or unwilling to provide any evidence, any meaningful evidence. There was a sort of a play a week or two ago when Tony Blair was set up to try to present it. I don't exactly know what the purpose of this was, maybe so that the U.S. could look as though it's holding back on some secret evidence that it can't reveal, or that Tony Blair could strike proper Churchillian poses or something or other. Whatever the PR reasons were, he gave a presentation which was, in serious circles, considered so absurd that it was barely even mentioned. So the Wall Street Journal, for example, one of the more serious papers, had a small story on page 12, I think, in which they pointed out that there isn't much evidence, and then they quoted some high U.S. official as saying it doesn't even matter whether there's any evidence because we're going to do it anyway. So why bother with the evidence? The more ideological press, like the New York Times and others, they had big front page headlines. But the Wall Street Journal reaction was reasonable, and if you look at the evidence, you can, so-called evidence, you can see why. But let's assume it's true. I mean, it was astonishing to me how weak the evidence was. I mean, I sort of thought you could do better than that without any intelligence service. In fact, remember, this was after weeks of the most intensive investigation in history of all the intelligence services of the Western world working overtime trying to put something together. And it was a prima facie, it was a very strong case even before you had anything. And it ended up about where it started, with a prima facie case. So let's assume it's true. So let's assume that, as you know, looked obvious the first day, still does, that the actual perpetrators come from the radical Islamic, here called fundamentalist, networks, of which the bin Laden network is undoubtedly a significant part. Whether they were involved or not, nobody knows. It doesn't really matter much. That's the background, those networks. Well, where do they come from? Well, we know all about that. Nobody knows about that better than the CIA because it helped organize them. And it nurtured them for a long time. They were brought together in the 1980s, actually, by the CIA and its associates elsewhere. Pakistan, Britain, France, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, China was involved. They may have even been involved a little bit earlier, maybe by 1978. The idea was to try to harass the Russians, the common enemy. According to President Carter's National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the U.S. got involved in mid-1979. You remember, just to put the dates right, that Russia invaded Afghanistan in December 1979. Okay. According to Brzezinski, the U.S. support for the Mujahideen fighting against the government began in 6 months earlier, and he's very proud of that. He says, we drew the Russians into, in his words, an Afghan trap by supporting the Mujahideen, getting them to invade, getting into the trap. Then we could develop this terrific mercenary army, not a small one, maybe 100,000 men or so, bringing together the best killers they could find, who were radical Islamist fanatics, from around North Africa, you know, Saudi Arabia, anywhere they can find them. They're often called the Afghanis, but many of them, like bin Laden, were not Afghans. You know, they were brought by the CIA and its friends elsewhere. Whether Brzezinski is telling the truth or not, I don't know. He may have been bragging. He's apparently very proud of it, knowing the consequences, incidentally. But maybe it's true. We'll know someday if the documents are ever released. Anyway, that's his perception. By January 1980, it's not even in doubt. The U.S. was organizing the Afghanis and this massive military force to try to cause the Russians maximal trouble. It was a legitimate thing for the Afghans to fight the Russian invasion, but the U.S. intervention was not helping the Afghans. In fact, it helped destroy the country and much more. The Afghanis, so-called, had their own it did force the Russians to withdraw, finally, although many analysts believe it probably delayed their withdrawal because they were trying to get out already. Anyway, whatever, they did withdraw. Meanwhile, the terrorist forces that the CIA was organizing, arming, and training, carrying it, were pursuing their own agenda right away. It was no secret. One of their first acts was in 1981, when they assassinated the president of Egypt, who was one of the most enthusiastic of their creators. In 1983, one suicide bomber, who may or may not have been connected, it's pretty shadowy, nobody knows, but one suicide bomber drove the US Army military out of Lebanon. And it continued. They have their own agenda. They're happy, the US was happy to mobilize them to fight its cause. But meanwhile, they're doing their own thing, and they were very clear about it. After 1989, when the Russians had withdrawn, they simply turned elsewhere. Since then, they've been fighting in Chechnya and Western China and Bosnia, Kashmir, Southeast Asia, North Africa, all over the place. They're telling us just what they think. I mean, you know, the United States wants to silence the one free television channel in the Arab world because it's broadcasting a whole range of things from Powell over to Osama bin Laden. So the U.S. is now joining the repressive regimes of the Arab world to try to shut it up. But if you listen to it, if you listen to what bin Laden says, it's worth it. I mean, there are plenty of interviews. And there are plenty of interviews by leading Western reporters, if you don't want to listen to his own voice, Robert Fisk and others. And what he's been saying is pretty consistent for a long time. He's not the only one, though maybe he's the most eloquent. It's not only consistent over a long time, it's consistent with their actions. So there's every reason to take it seriously. Their prime enemy is the what they call the corrupt and oppressive, authoritarian, brutal regimes of the Arab world. And when they say that, they get quite a resonance in the region. They also want to defend, and they want to replace them by properly Islamist governments. That's where they lose the people of the region. But up till then, they're with them. From their point of view, even Saudi Arabia, the most extreme fundamentalist state in the world, I suppose, short of the Taliban, which is an offshoot, even that's not Islamist enough for them. Has even more than that. Okay, at that point, they get very little support. But up until that point, they get plenty of support. Also, they want to defend Muslims elsewhere. They hate the Russians like poison. But as soon as the Russians pulled out of Afghanistan, they stopped carrying out terrorist acts in Russia, as they'd been doing with CIA backing before that in Russia, not just in Afghanistan. They did move over to Chechnya, but there they're defending Muslims against the Russian invasion. Same with all the other places I mentioned. From their point of view, they're defending Muslims against the infidels. And they're very clear about it, and that's what they've been doing. Why did they turn against the United States? Well, that had to do with what they called the U.S. invasion of Saudi Arabia. In 1990, the U.S. established permanent military bases in Saudi Arabia, which, from their point of view, is comparable to the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, except that Saudi Arabia is way more important. That's the home of the holiest sites of Islam. And that's when their activities turned against the United States. You recall that in 1993, they tried to blow up the World Trade Center. Got part of the way, but not the whole way, and that was only part of it. The plans were to blow up the UN building, the Holland and Lincoln tunnels, the FBI building. I think there were others on the list. Well, they sort of got part way, but not all the way. The person who was jailed for that, finally, among the people who was jailed, was an Egyptian cleric who had been brought into the United States over the objections of the Immigration Service, thanks to the intervention of the CIA, which wanted to help out their friend. A couple of years later, he was blown up the World Trade Center. And this has been going on all over. I'm not going to run through the list, but it's kind of, I mean, you can, you know, you might as well, if you want to understand it, it's consistent. It's a consistent picture. It's described in words. It's revealed in practice for 20 years. No reason not to take it seriously.
Professor Noam Chomsky giving major anti-war address last week at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he is a professor of linguistics. We're going to continue with that speech after the break. If you want to order a video cassette copy for yourself, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. You can also order it through Free Speech TV, which is where we're broadcasting on now over Dish Network Channel 9415. But you can go to their website at freespeech.org. You're listening to The War and Peace Report. We'll be back with Noam Chomsky in a minute.
Lift every voice and sing.
Lift every voice and sing, Say Your Business, a live recording by Linda Tillery and the Cultural Heritage Choir. You are listening to the War and Peace Report with Anthony Sloan at the controls. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go back to Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at MIT, where he gave a major anti-war address last week.
What about the reservoir of support? Well, it's not hard to find out what that is. There's some discussion. One of the good things that's happened since September 11th is that some of the press and some discussion has begun to open up to some of these things. The best one, to my knowledge, is the Wall Street Journal, which right away began to run, within a couple of days, serious reports, searching serious reports on the reasons why people of the region, even if they hate bin Laden and despise everything he's doing, nevertheless support him in many ways and even regard him as the conscience of Islam, as one said. Now, the Wall Street Journal and others, they're not surveying public opinion. They're surveying the opinion of their friends, bankers, professionals, international lawyers, businessmen tied to the United States, you know, people who they interview in McDonald's restaurants, which is an elegant restaurant. They're wearing fancy American clothes. That's the people they're interviewing because they want to find out what their attitudes are. And their attitudes are very explicit and very clear and in many ways consonant with the message of bin Laden and others. They are very angry at the United States because of its support of authoritarian and brutal regimes, its intervention to block any move towards democracy, its intervention to stop economic development, its policies of devastating the civilian society of Iraq while strengthening Saddam Hussein, and roughly. And when bin Laden gives those reasons, yeah, people recognize it and support it. Now, that's not the way people here like to think about it, at least educated liberal opinion. They like the following line, which has been all over the press, mostly from left liberals, incidentally. I've done a real study, but I think right-wing opinion has generally been more honest. But if you look at, say, at the New York Times, first op-ed they ran by Ronald Steele, a serious left liberal intellectual, he asked, why do they hate us? This is the same day, I think, that the Wall Street Journal was running the survey on why they hate us. So he says, they hate us because we champion a new world order of capitalism, individualism, secularism, and democracy that should be the norm everywhere. That's why they hate us. Same day, the Wall Street Journal is surveying the opinions of bankers, professionals, international lawyers, and saying, look, we hate you because you're blocking democracy, you're preventing economic development, you're supporting brutal regimes, terrorist regimes, and you're doing these horrible things in the region. A couple of days later, Anthony Lewis, way out on the left, explained that the terrorists seek only apocalyptic nihilism, nothing more, and nothing we do matters. The only consequence of our actions, he says, that could be harmful is that it makes it harder to join for Arabs to join in the coalition's anti-terrorism effort. But beyond that, everything we do is irrelevant. That's got the advantage of being sort of comforting, makes you feel good about yourself and how wonderful you are. It enables us to evade the consequences of our actions. It has a couple of defects. One is it's totally at variance with everything we know. And another defect is it's a perfect way to ensure that you escalate the cycle of violence. If you want to live with your head buried in the sand and pretend they hate us because they're opposed to globalization. That's why they killed Sadat 20 years ago and fought the Russians and tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. And these are all people who are right in the midst of what the corporate globalization. But if you want to believe that, yeah, it's comforting. And it's a great way to make sure that violence escalates. That's tribal violence. You did something to me, I'll do something worse to you. I don't care what the reasons are, and we just keep going that way. That's a way to do it. Pretty much straight left liberal opinion. What are the policy options? Well, there are a number. A narrow policy option from the beginning was to follow the advice of really far out radicals like the Pope and Vatican immediately said, look, it's a horrible terrorist crime. In the case of a crime, you try to find the perpetrators, you bring them to justice, you try them, you don't kill innocent civilians. Like if somebody robs my house and I think the guy who did it is probably in a neighborhood across the street, I don't go out with an assault rifle and kill everybody in that neighborhood. That's not the way you deal with a crime, whether it's a small crime like this one or a really massive one like the U.S. terrorist war against Nicaragua and even worse ones and others in between. And there are plenty of precedents for that. In fact, I mentioned a precedent, Nicaragua, a lawful state, a law-abiding state, which is presumably why we had to destroy it, which followed the right principles. Now, of course, it didn't get anywhere because it was running up against a power that wouldn't allow lawful procedures to be followed. But if the United States tried to pursue them, nobody would stop it. In fact, everyone would applaud. And there are plenty of other precedents. When the IRA set off bombs in London, which was a pretty serious business, Britain could, apart from the fact that it was unfeasible, let's put that aside, one possible response would have been to destroy Boston, which is the source of most of the financing, and of course to wipe out West Belfast. Well, quite apart from feasibility, it would have been criminal idiocy. The way to deal with it was pretty much what they did. Find the perpetrators, bring them to trial, and look for the reasons. Because these things don't come out of nowhere, They come out of something. And whether it's a crime in the streets or a monstrous terrorist crime or anything else, there's reasons. And usually if you look at the reasons, some of them are legitimate. And ought to be addressed independently of the crime. They ought to be addressed because they're legitimate. And that's the way you deal with it. There's many such examples. But there are problems with that. One problem is that the United States does not recognize the jurisdiction of international institutions, so it can't go to them. It has rejected the jurisdiction of the World Court. It's refused to ratify the International Criminal Court. It's powerful enough to set up a new court if it wants, so that wouldn't stop anything. But there's a problem with any kind of a court, namely you need evidence. You go to any kind of court, you're going to need some kind of evidence, not Tony Blair talking on television. And that's very hard. It may be impossible to find. It could be that the people who did it killed themselves. These are nobody knows this better than the CIA. These are decentralized, non-hierarchic networks. They follow a principle that's called leaderless resistance. That's the principle that's been developed by the Christian right terrorists in the United States. It's called leaderless resistance. You have small groups that do things. They don't talk to anybody else. There's a kind of a general background of assumptions, and then you do it. Actually, people in the anti-war movement are very familiar with this. We just call it affinity groups. If you're doing, if you assume correctly that whatever your group you're in is being penetrated by the FBI, when something serious is happening, you don't do it in a meeting. You do it with some people you know and trust, an affinity group, and then it doesn't get penetrated. That's one of the reasons why the FBI has never been able to figure out what's going on in any of the popular movements. And other intelligence agencies are the same. They can't, you know. That's leaderless resistance, or affinity groups and decentralized networks are extremely hard to penetrate. And it's quite possible that they just don't know. When Osama bin Laden claims he wasn't involved, that's entirely possible. In fact, it's pretty hard to imagine how a guy in a cave in Afghanistan who doesn't even have a radio or a telephone could have planned a highly sophisticated operation like that. Chances are it's part of the background, you know, like other leaderless resistance terrorist groups, which means it's going to be extremely hard to find evidence. The U.S. doesn't want to present evidence because it wants to be able to do it to act without evidence. That's a crucial part of the reaction. You'll notice that the U.S. did not ask for Security Council authorization, which they probably could have gotten this time, not for pretty reasons, but because the other permanent members of the Security Council are also terrorist states. They are happy to join a coalition against what they call terror, namely in support of their own terror. Like Russia wasn't going to veto it. They love it. You know? So the U.S. probably could have gotten Security Council authorization, but it didn't want it. And it didn't want it because it follows a long-standing principle, which is not George Bush. It was explicit in the Clinton administration, articulated, and goes back much further. And that is that we have the right to act unilaterally. We don't want international authorization because we act unilaterally. We don't want it. We don't care about evidence. We don't care about negotiation. We don't care about treaties. We're the strongest guy around, you know, toughest thug on the block. We do what we want. Authorization is a bad thing, and therefore must be avoided. There's even a name for it in the technical literature. It's called establishing credibility. You have to establish credibility. That's an important factor in many policies. It was the official reason given for the war in the Balkans, and the most plausible reason. You want to know what credibility means? Ask your favorite mafia don. He'll explain to you what credibility means. And it's the same in international affairs, except, you know, it's talked about in universities. You do it with big words and that sort of thing. But it's basically the same principle. And it makes sense, and it usually works. Main historian who's written about this for the last several hundred years is Charles Tilly, his book called Coercion and Violence, and he points out that violence has been the leading principle of Europe for hundreds of years, and the reason is because it works. You know, it's very reasonable. It almost always works when you have an overwhelming predominance of violence and a culture of violence behind it. So therefore, it makes sense to follow it. Well, those are all problems in pursuing lawful paths. And if you did try to follow them, you'd really open some very dangerous doors. Like the U.S. is demanding that the Taliban hand over Osama bin Laden. And they're responding in a way which is regarded as totally absurd and outlandish in the West. Namely, they're saying, okay, but first give us some evidence. That is, in the West, that's considered ludicrous. It's a sign of their criminality, you know. How can they ask for evidence? I mean, if somebody asked us to hand someone over, we'd do it tomorrow. We wouldn't ask for any evidence. In fact, it's easy to prove that. We don't have to make up cases. So, for example, for the last several years, Haiti has been requesting the United States to extradite Emmanuel Constant, who's a major killer. He was one of the leading figures in the slaughter of maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people in the years in the mid-90s under the military junta, which incidentally was being not so tacitly supported by the Bush and the Clinton administrations, contrary to illusions. Anyway, he's a leading killer. They got plenty of evidence, no problem about evidence. He's already been brought to trial and sentenced in Haiti, and they're asking the United States to turn him over. Well, I mean, do your own research. See how much discussion there's been of that. Actually, Haiti renewed the request a couple of weeks ago. It wasn't even mentioned. Why should we turn over a convicted killer who was largely responsible for killing 4,000 or 5,000 people a couple of years ago? In fact, if we do turn him over, who knows what he'll say? Maybe he'll say that he was being funded by and helped by the CIA, which is probably true. We don't want to open that door. And he's not the only one. I mean, for the last about 15 years, Costa Rica, which is, you know, the democratic prize, has been trying to get the United States to hand over a John Hull, a U.S. landowner in Costa Rica, who they charge with terrorist crimes. He was using his land, they claim, with good evidence, as a base for the U.S. war against Nicaragua, which is not a controversial conclusion, remember. There's the World Court and the Security Council behind it. So they've been trying to get the United States to hand him over. Hear about that one? No. They did actually confiscate the land of another American landholder, John Hamilton, paid compensation, offered compensation. The U.S. refused, turned his land over to a national park, because his land was also being used as a base for the U.S. attack against Nicaragua. Costa Rica was punished for that one. They were punished by withholding aid. We don't accept that kind of insubordination from allies. And we can go on. If you open the door to questions about extradition, it leads in very unpleasant directions, so that can't be done. Well, what about reactions in Afghanistan? The initial proposal, the initial rhetoric, was for a massive assault, which would kill many people visibly, and also an attack on other countries of the region. Well, the Bush administration wisely backed off from that. They were being told by every foreign leader, you know, NATO, everyone else, every specialist, I suppose their own intelligence agencies, that would be the stupidest thing they could possibly do. It would simply be like opening recruiting offices for bin Laden all over the region. That's exactly what he wants, and it would be extremely harmful to their own interests. So they backed off that one. They're turning to what I described earlier, which is a kind of silent genocide. Well, I already said what I think about it. I don't think anything has to be said. You can figure it out if you do the arithmetic. Is a sensible proposal, which is kind of on the verge of being considered, but it's been sensible all along, and is being asked, called for by expatriate Afghans and allegedly tribal leaders internally, is for a UN initiative, which would keep the Russians and the Americans out of it totally. These are the two countries that have practically wiped the country out in the last 20 years. They should be out of it. They should provide massive reparations, but that's their only role. A UN initiative to bring together elements within Afghanistan that would try to construct something from the wreckage. It's conceivable that that could work with plenty of support and no interference. If the U.S. insists on running it, you might as well quit. We have a historical record on that one. You'll notice that the name of this operation, remember, at first it was going to be a crusade, but they backed off that because PR agents told them that wouldn't work. And then it was going to be infinite justice, but the PR agents said, wait a minute, you're sounding like you're divinity, so that wouldn't work. And then it was changed to enduring freedom. We know what that means, but nobody has yet pointed out, fortunately, that there's an ambiguity there. To endure means to suffer. You know? And there are plenty of other people around the world who have endured what we call freedom. Again, fortunately, we have a very well-behaved, educated class, so nobody has yet pointed out this ambiguity. But if it's done, there'll be another problem to deal with. But if we can back off enough so that some more or less independent agency, maybe the UN, maybe credible NGOs, can take the lead and trying to reconstruct something from the wreckage with plenty of assistance, and we owe it to them, then maybe something would come out. Beyond that, there are other problems. We certainly want to reduce the level of terror, certainly not escalate it. There's one easy way to do that, and therefore it's never discussed, namely stop participating in it. That would automatically reduce the level of terror enormously, but that you can't discuss. Well, we ought to make it possible to discuss it. So that's one easy way to reduce the level of terror. Beyond that, we should rethink the kinds of policies, and Afghanistan's not the only one, in which we organize and train terrorist armies. That has effects. We're seeing some of the effects now. September 11th is one. Rethink it. Rethink the policies that are creating a reservoir of support. Exactly what the bankers and lawyers and so on are saying in places like Saudi Arabia and on the streets. It's much more bitter, as you can imagine. That's possible. You know, those policies aren't graven in stone. And furthermore, there are opportunities. It's hard to find many rays of light in the last couple of weeks, but one of them is that there is an increased openness. Lots of issues are open for discussion, even in elite circles, certainly among the general public, that were not a couple of weeks ago. That's dramatically the case. I mean, if a newspaper like, say, USA Today can run a very good article, serious article, on life in the Gaza Strip, there's been a change. The things I mentioned in the Wall Street Journal, that's change. And among the general public, I think there's much more openness and willingness to think about things that were under the rug and so on. These are opportunities, and they should be used, at least by people who accept the goal of trying to reduce the level of violence and terror, including potential threats that are extremely severe and could make even September 11th pale into insignificance.
Professor Noam Chomsky, speaking last week at his university, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. If you'd like to order a video cassette copy of the full speech we played, the first half of it yesterday, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. You can also order it online at freespeech.org. Freespeech.org is Free Speech TV, and that's the nonprofit 24-hour channel on Dish Network 9415, where we broadcast every day, as well as on community radio stations around the country and on the internet at wbix.org, as well as webactive.com. You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. When we return, that was Noam Chomsky speaking at a major anti-war event in Boston. We're going to hear what people are doing around the country. Stay with us.
Oh, 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 oh. We all want. How many songs must we sing for justice? How many nights before we see the sun? Before we know that all we are is justice. Before we know that all we are is one. We are one. We are one.
Planet rich with an abundance of food, yet tens of thousands die every day of starvation. A planet occupied by...
We are one here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. This is Free Speech Radio. protests around the country and the world. About 2,000 Palestinians demonstrated today against Israel's incursions into the Palestinian-controlled areas of the West Bank. Afghanistan's opposition urged the United States and its allies today to work harder to prevent civilian casualties in the bombing of Afghanistan. Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, the opposition's foreign minister, said bombing raids against Taliban positions had inflicted more pain on a people who had already suffered under the rule of, quote, terrorists. Abdullah is on his way to meet commanders in the northeastern town of Khoja Bahawuddin and said the opposition Northern Alliance had received confirmed accounts of civilian casualties during the bombing raids. He said many Afghans had been killed or wounded in the southern city of Kandahar and the eastern city of Jalalabad in the strikes, which Washington and its allies launched earlier this month. Pakistani police fired tear gas to disperse thousands of demonstrators in Karachi after 35 Pakistani militants were killed by U.S. bombing in Kabul. In the United States, there have been teach-ins and rallies and protests around the country. About a week ago, we played the comments of listeners in Olympia, Washington, and heard about how they were organizing. Last night, here in New York, there was a teach-in at Riverside Church, tonight one at Hunter College. And every Wednesday night in New York, and this does happen around the country, women in black gather in front of the New York Public Library at 5:30 to protest the bombing of Afghanistan. Anyway, we put out the call over the last few weeks to ask what people were doing, and this is what some of you had to say.
This is Ann Goldstein, and I am calling from Boulder, Colorado, listening, of course, to KGNU. After your program about women in black last week, we decided to pull together women in black here in Boulder, and we actually had a silent vigil today from 5 to 6 o'clock, and there were 50 women at that, and that was actually just pulled together by word of mouth and email over 1 week. No particular organization sponsored it. It was just word of mouth about women in black. So we did want to thank you very much for your program, and people were really inspired by that. And we are going to continue to do a silent vigil every Wednesday from 5 to 6 in the middle of Boulder, Colorado.
My name is Thoreau, and not being a morning person, I am pleased to be listening to your second hour on KGNU in Colorado. What I'm doing is war tax resistance. I've been a war tax refuser since we went to war with Iraq. And in my mind these days, I see a conflict between people that are working for peace and continuing to pay for war. I don't know, it's a simple equation that just doesn't add up in my books. I think it's a powerful strategy. I haven't quite figured out how to best organize it. There's a huge fear factor, but in these days we just all have to do what we're afraid to do. The first thing our government did since this all happened was to freeze assets of people overseas and such, and that basically shows me how effective the strategy can be. What we're doing is freezing assets. And knowing that the country was founded on taxation without representation, that was one of the cores of the original revolution, I think that war tax resistance is perhaps the last best chance to build community and to create a grassroots movement that can be quickly and profoundly effective.
This is Nancy Fisher from Santa Fe, New Mexico. I listen to KUNM in Albuquerque, 89.9. I'm a realtor, and the realtors in our community are backing an initiative for the whole community to band together and make this a safe place for everyone to live. We're organizing volunteers who will drive people if they're afraid of appearing in public. We're instituting training on how to ally with anyone who needs support in these difficult times. This training will be in the schools and in the community. We're enlisting businesses to put a symbol in their window that means all people are safe here. We believe that by making our community strong,
this is something we can do in a positive direction during these terrible times.
I want to read the announcement of the fundraiser that I'm organizing. Women Read for RAWA. Women writers read their own and other women authors' writing. A fundraiser for the Revolutionary Association for the Women of Afghanistan. Help Afghani women refugees and the feminist organization fighting the Taliban in their war against women. Afghani women have been the first and the worst hit victims of the Taliban. They have also been the most courageous and determined opponents to toxic religious fanaticism.
Hey, my name is Danny. I'm listening in the Bronx to WFMU, I believe. And I'm a painter, and I've been focusing all my energy on painting images related to what's been going on with the World Trade Center. I was down as close as I could get, sort of painting the spectator's perspective. Also, I did a scene of the Union Square focusing on the image of the George Washington sculpture statue with the peace symbols on it, and I'm hoping to have the possibility of exhibiting, maybe connecting with other artists who are for peace and for a more humane attitude towards the world, and possibly, you know, getting our perspective out a little bit through our art.
Hi, my name is Joan Johnson. I listen to KFAI. I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And my boyfriend and I and a lot of other friends have been doing a lot of different things. But the main thing my boyfriend and I decided to do was, first of all, make 10 signs, because we're part of a weekly vigil on Wednesday nights on the Lake Street Marshall Avenue Bridge, and to say no to the bombing. And we've been a part of a vigil for 2.5 years, and now we've moved into the current situation. And so we made new signs, and they were actually for his birthday. I asked him what he wanted for his birthday, and he said he wanted us to make 10 new posters. And so that's what we did. And then we also have a big black poster representing the darkness. And then each time we do an action or educate someone or write a letter or make a phone call, we put a candle on it with the theme of it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness, because you can get feeling real despairing and powerless in light of the whole horrible situation in Afghanistan.
My name is Paul Deffenbach. I listen to KPFA in the Bay Area. I am my activity is to oppose those on the left who are creating a moral equivalency of the United States bombing of Afghanistan, which is oriented towards military targets and the terrorists, trying to take the moral equivalency of that as the same as the actions of the terrorists against the Trade Center, where they specifically targeted civilians. There is no moral equivalency between the two, and it is my job to root out those who say so, and tell all that that the United States is fighting a righteous war against an evil enemy. Thank you.
My name is Greg Giorgio. I listen to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report on WRPI in Troy, serving the upstate New York, Eastern Region, Capital District area, and also parts of Western New England and Southern Vermont and Western Massachusetts. I helped organize and represent a group called the Good Friday Coalition, who has been out since the Friday after September 11th in preparation for what we were certain was going to be a violent response and retaliation. We are doing a peace vigil and informational picket every Friday morning at 11 a.m. in downtown Schenectady, New York, at the Armed Forces Recruiting Center. We started out roughly because of police interference early on. Our free speech rights were being violated, and we had to work hard to ensure that our First Amendment rights would be protected to protest the use of violent retaliation against anyone. And we're basically labor and social justice activists who are interested in preserving the message of nonviolence and a non-retaliatory solution to the world's problems, and recognize the class-conscious notion that these are the bosses' wars fought for the purposes of profit.
I'm in Santa Rosa, California.
what I'm doing. When I see people wearing red, white, and blue, when I see people in pain, I have a small card with a gray ribbon tied to it that I hand them. Wear gray ribbon as a call for reason and compassion in the midst of insanity. Wear gray for the courage to ask why. Wear gray that other innocents need not be sacrificed. Wear gray to speak for our precious civil rights. Gray is the color that lies between black and white, and there is not black and white in the decision to war. Gray is the color of ashes. Gray is the color of the dove. Tie gray to your red, white, and blue to speak for truth, American values, peace, justice, and civil rights.
Hi, my name is Penny. I am in Berkeley, California. What I'm doing in the war, I'm disabled and I'm an artist. And there's an arts disability program in Berkeley. And my friends and I are having make your own flag workshops. It actually wasn't my idea, but a friend of mine went to one and brought the idea back. And many of us are putting our flags on our wheelchairs, and others are in the window or on doors. And we've had materials donated, and we've just also gone through our own supplies and donated. And it's really been an affirming thing. It was a very healing process to be doing it and talking about it with other people, to come up with our ideas about what we think, and to see other people's expressing their ideas all in art.
I'm a Vietnam veteran. Originally was a conscientious objector, which was rejected by the U.S. government. So I spent 2 years as a war resister, actually in uniform. I believe that war today is obsolete. I mean, all the anthrax stuff that's going on. I mean, we have to believe in human nature around the world, whatever nationality it is. I'm listening in Oakland, California to KPFA.
David Reardon.
And you've been listening to the voices of listeners and viewers around the country who are talking about what they're doing in their own communities. And you too can call us at 212-209-2999 and let us know what you're doing in this time of war. I said earlier in the program that Farid Isaac would be with us. Well, he is going to join us tomorrow. He's author of the book Quran, Liberation, and Pluralism, an Islamic Perspective of Interreligious Solidarity Against Oppression. He is a professor, senior lecturer in religion at the University of the Western Cape, South Africa, internationally known scholar and activist, was an member of the ANC in South Africa, and we'll talk about Pakistan, South Africa, and liberation on our program tomorrow. As has happened quite often in this city, this very troubled city, as he attempted to get down here, it took him about an hour and a half, what normally would have been a 20-minute ride. Here at the just a block from where we are, the roadblock still stands. There are Humvees, there are National Guard and police and sheriffs and state police. We are, again, broadcasting just blocks from ground zero as the emergency workers, the evacuation crews, continue to dig through the rubble as those same kinds of people, emergency crews, dig through the rubble of Afghanistan. That does it for the program. Again, if you'd like to order the video cassette of the speech of Noam Chomsky or Howard Zinn, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. Or go to the website, freespeech.org. That's www.freespeech.org. And you can order it there. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy with help from Janice K. Bryant, and we welcome her to our exiled studios, another producer in exile. Anthony Sloan is our technical director, Errol Maitland at the helm at www.wbix.org. Thanks to Amy Pomerleau at KPFA and Free Speech Radio news producer Aaron Glantz, and especially here at Downtown Community Television to John Alpert and Keiko Sunu, a very gracious thank you. We are broadcasting just blocks from the World Trade Center in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Disregard the mainstream, media are distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media are distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media are distorted. We come and listen and support it.
If I could have some peace and love, tu t'allonges sur ton dos.
Yeah.
Tu es toujours. Tu te marques des brimaux. Tu t'enfonces dans ta
main.
With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level.
We have more breaking news. We have recently confirmed report that at 2:35 this afternoon, Governor Franklin died from a gunshot wound to the head. The wound was apparently self-inflicted. In the aftermath of this, reports have surfaced all over the internet about the truth to this whole story that the mainstream media has refused to report.
That's right. You know, I really feel that it's time, personally, that we start to take the media into our own hands and become the media ourselves. We need to start opening our own stations. In fact, I've heard there's a lot of stations opening up all around the country.
Freeze his FBI down!
The FBI is busting in the door!
Shut that thing up!
Get out!
Get ass down on the ground!